had real doubts as to whether this was going to result in better service. But it did, and they could see that it actually did. There was actually a free movement where some of the smaller communities wanted to be freed from the burdens of being part of a big city that emerged a couple of years after the amalgamation. And they were doing a radio show, and I was driving in the car. And one of them said, so we want to be freed of all this bureaucratic nonsense of the big city, except the library. We want the library to stay the same.
Well, like there's a testimonials.
Yeah, and that was a constant comment, was that the library was actually better in the amalgamation.
So, Ken, just shifting gears a little bit, you've been involved in influencing and advocating on national issues.
Yes.
And so you've been involved with Kulk and Sandra Singh and the group who are leading, I think it's called Readers First in Canada too, around influencing some of the larger publishers and the small Canadian presses to engage with libraries in a different way. Can you talk a little bit about that process on the kinds of things to talk to for-profit organizations and how they engage with libraries and the decline of the independent retail store and the threats to our culture if our small press Canadian publishers and our literary presses fail to get represented to Canadians?
Boy, there's about a dozen questions inside there.
Yeah.
I think that of e-books, that it is a huge concern that the small Canadian presses are kind of lost in that larger American context. It's almost impossible to find many of the Canadian materials or the books that are there. It is. That's a big issue, and it's one where we're having, for the first time in many, many years, direct conversations between the publishers and the libraries to see what we can do to correct that issue. The Readers First, and I'd probably categorize the main component of Readers First as saying that as we move into the e-world, we have to make sure that the systems are open enough that a library can function as a library. We can't have it where you have to know to go to one product to get the Penguin books, and then you have to come out of that product and go into another product to get the HarperCollins books. You have to come out of that product and go into another product to reach the Random House book. That would just be ridiculous. I mean, you couldn't see a library where the material would be shelved along the walls by a publisher, or that you had to walk out of a library building and go to the one next door to see books by a different publisher.
Or the walled gardens where the book only works on a Kindle.
Yeah, or this one will work on a Kindle, that one is an EPUB, this one's that one, this one can be borrowed for 14 days, that one you can only take it out a chapter at a time and then have to return it. So it's not we felt that in the e-world what we were beginning to see was one where that it was not seamless for the user in terms of even knowing how long you had each book, even if you could get them all on your device, and where you would go in order to find that material. So the purpose of Readers First is saying that the reader needs the material. They need it at a reasonable price for the library to be able to afford it, and they need it under reasonable and consistent conditions so that there is some ability of the reader, the person who is using it at the end, to understand how long they're going to have it for and the conditions of use, and that it's easy to find it. So what we were seeing is vendors creating walls, we're still seeing it, vendors creating walls where it's easy to use their product, but they're actually putting barriers between their product and other products and making it hard for you to find other material. So what we're trying to do by that national conversation to Canada and the United States is, as much as we possibly can, show the necessity of removing those walls. And it, as you can understand, where vendors want a certain share of the marketplace, that's a really tough discussion.
So the challenges of talking to those folks, where there's always been a love-hate relationship between the vendor-publisher community and libraries,
yes,
and the absolute necessity that we both need each other, as we're sitting on the shifting sands of this stuff, what are those conversations like? Like we're trying to influence, and they're obviously trying to influence us.
Well, I think it is going to result in a changed relationship. And by the way, I don't think we've done ourselves any favors at all. You know, there was the big movement, it still exists in the States quite a bit, where that economic impact calculator that you could put on a website that would you could sort of determine how many books you had checked out and how much you would have paid for those if you'd actually purchased them, and therefore how much money the library was saving you. Publishers have turned around and showed us those same calculators and said, by God, that actually tells me how much more money I would have made if the library didn't exist. You know, and we say, no, that's not the case, because actually readers breed readers, and they actually find material they want to buy. But that part of the equation is unproven. So I think we've actually made it as a bad argument when we sort of say our economic impact means that people don't have to buy as many books. Whoa, the publisher then turns around and says, that's my business, is to actually sell books, and you're stopping me from doing it.
So that's been some of the good stuff that ALA has done around the ALA-LJ surveys that showed that libraries generate book sales as well.
Yes.
So within the culture of libraries, how do we work with our colleagues to influence them? We've got 4 or 5 libraries in Canada right now doing the pilot project for Readers First and Kulk that will involve selling books to the libraries, or recommending books for libraries to buy, or borrowing books to the libraries within the same interface.
Yes, and I think actually if you'd asked me 5 or 10 years ago if I was in favor of selling books on a library's website, I probably would have downright absolutely said no. And now, after long conversations with the publishers, I'd actually say yes. And the reason why is that they're losing places that they can sell material. And what they're left with is Amazon or Apple. And you're beginning to wind up with Amazon and Apple that are controlling the marketplace to the extent that, you know, too much of the material is being sold through 1 or 2 sites. And I think that when the publishers look at the amount of traffic we have that goes through library websites and is looking for material, they see that as an opportunity, and particularly in Canada with Canadian presses, as you mentioned, that if we actually have an opportunity to sell that material electronically in a country that is so spread out with a 35 million population, that offers them enormous opportunity to make sure they can continue publishing material. And really, libraries can't survive unless we have a healthy publishing community. And that's really being threatened right now.
So maybe this is a good place to talk about the role of compromise. Like there's things, like we could all sit there, you know, say like, oh, e-books are doing this, or I love my Kindle or whatever.
Yep.
But the Kindle is a walled garden to create an economic zone.
Yep.
The Apple iStore, for all intents and purposes, is a massive censorship engine that actually censors the insides of books. We're also looking at things we care about in Canada, Canadian culture and Canadian poets and authors and novelists and short story people losing their front window. And those small independent bookstores that you could go to and find things on the shelf that matched me seeing my culture. Or reading a story where Bloor Street was in it, or Wingham, Ontario. And, you know, I don't know if in the new world a Nobel Prize winner could come out talking about Wingham again.
No, and that's very true. And if you go back even 5 or 6 years, publishers say that a Midland fiction title was selling during the course of the lifetime of its being in print, about 7,000 copies. Now they say a Midland fiction title is selling 3,000 copies. And that's because of the disappearance of places where those books can actually be sold. So if they're losing that amount of share because there's no place for them to sell material, and we want that to thrive, then I think we have to step in and help.
So how do we move that along? Like, what are the influencing criteria for talking about that? Obviously, you're starting, like, you're demonstrating it. Vancouver and Toronto and Hamilton and others stepping up to the plate to try the new system and create a new book experience that's maybe a little Amazon-like, but also in a library context and a local context, and maybe a little more Canadian content in it than we've been able to do. I know in 1960, Canada published about 10,000 books a year, which meant that many libraries could buy them all. Now we publish more than that, and we can't afford to buy them all.
I think you've actually answered it, haven't you? You know, I mean, I think we have to step up and be places where that material can be sold, and we are experimenting with it. What we're doing is sort of a pilot to see, well, what's the net impact? Can you actually sell enough books to make it so that it does have an impact? Because we don't know that yet.
So I'll ask one last question before I open it up for questions. And so start thinking about your questions, folks. The hotspot issues, porn in the library, teens behaving badly, which I don't really think is as bad a problem as it's sometimes made out to be, or filters. There's a couple of hotspot topics that hit public libraries all the time. How do you manage that in terms of advocating for the role of libraries as a free and open space?
Well, of course, I've said for many years that the issue with filters is that, and now it is proving to be the case, is the issue is not whether the library itself filters. The issue is what type of viewing are you permitting inside the library, because now people have a variety of networks that they can link into themselves. Even if you filter, somebody could still have a tablet that they're linking into Rogers or Bell or Telus or whatever, and be viewing that material inside the library. So the issue is not filtering or not filtering. The issue is what is permissible for viewing inside the library. So I've never felt that filtering was the answer. And filtering also, to me, says that a technology will solve the issue. And in fact, we know the technology does not solve the issue. What actually solves the issue is clear policy that is understood by staff and who are willing to actually approach people that are looking at something that may be purely pornographic inside the library, which doesn't happen very often.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to open up for questions. So, Jay, if you can explain to them how to ask a question, and we'll be ready to go.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, that is star 1 if you have a question at this time. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
And I know that Ken is a great question answerer, and he'll take any question. But I'll take this moment to remind everybody that we've got a few more webinars coming up. On November 21st, we have Professor Wendy Newman, who's well known to us, talking about the top 6 best practices for advocates in any setting. And then we've got another teleconference on November 27th and another webinar on December 12th with Ken Haycock talking about networking for positive influence and positioning. Then we've got some more teleconferences in December and January. So I know many of you have registered for the whole works, and I'm looking forward to engaging with you more in our role as the Federation of Ontario Public Libraries.
So basically, you have all my best friends coming in.
Yeah, and all my best friends, too.
Yeah.
I like to be around people who are good at what they do.
Ladies and gentlemen, please press star 1 if there are any questions at this time.
Oh, I guess we're waiting for questions. Come on, guys.
I'm sure that selling books inside the library could raise some questions.
Uh-huh. I think it's one of the more interesting challenges of our time, because I really see it as what's our core value system? Are libraries part of the cultural fabric of our country? And when that fabric is being threatened,
and it is,
I know you need to sell 5,000 books to make money, and if it's gone down to 3, that's not good for our poets, short story writers, and, you know, could you get the new authors out there, or are they going to have to self-publish, and then the publishers are, like, you know, 50 Shades of Grey started out as a self-published novel, and then it was cherry-picked when it started selling well and moved into the professional publishing marketing dynamic.
And boy, there's a big issue, because, you know, if you look at music, where a lot of bands put their music out free, mm-hmm. and then they began to tour and make their money through touring, is we have developed a culture which is used to receiving material for free.
Yeah, that's how Justin Bieber started, for good or ill.
Yeah.
I remember him when he was a little kid playing out in front of the Avon Theater in Stratford. So are we not getting any questions? Come on, folks.
We do have a question at the moment.
Great.
From Bracebridge Public Library. Your line is open.
Hello, Bracebridge. Tell us who you are.
Hello there. This is Catherine Rodney calling. I'm the CEO, and I have one of our board members sitting in today. One of the things that I'm noticing, certainly in our library, and I don't know if it's because we're small town in Muskoka, we do seem to be getting a lot of people coming up from southern Ontario who are used to great library service. And we're getting a very strong sense that people are really wanting print material. We've done surveys of our users, and we even did a couple of focus groups with the students from the two high schools. And the consensus, even among those teens, was that they prefer print. So I'm just wondering, you know, a lot of this ebook seems to be publisher-driven in a lot of cases, from what I can tell. And I'm just wondering, our libraries, should we be taking any sort of role in trying to advocate on the part of our patrons?
Ken, how do you want to deal with that?
Libraries account for about 2% of the publishing industry's business. So we're very small, which is even one reason why they haven't been negotiating a lot of those agreements, because we don't represent a large part of their business. I think that it is true that there are many people who say, no, I prefer it in print, but the economics are going to rule the day. As you probably know that Florida, for example, is stating that their ebook initiative is supposed to be in place by 2015, with at least half the K-12 textbooks in the entire state being electronic. The state of Florida is undergoing their open source textbook initiative and has much of that material online at the present time, and is looking towards tablets for every student from K-12 inside the entire state. And one of their reasons really is that textbooks become out of date so frequently, and they're so expensive to publish, and the e-readers have become so inexpensive that what they can actually do is supply an e-reader and the textbook material for much less money than it costs them to provide the textbooks themselves. So what we're seeing is the beginnings of a revolution that we're not going to be able to influence whether or not we like print or don't like print. If we are stuck within the print world, if that's where the public identifies as what a library is just print, then we will be receiving an increasingly smaller portion of the business. And you can see that right now in bestsellers, because bestsellers are actually selling more electronic copies than they are print copies. And I've talked to a number of people, at least in the larger libraries, that are saying it is definitely influencing the number of print material books that they're buying of those particular items, because they're not being borrowed as frequently. People are just getting them electronically, either through the library or buying them, because they're not that expensive.
So, I'd also add to what Ken is saying, the overall demographics are, so we're looking at one-third, one-third, one-third on ebooks. One-third of books, nonfiction and fiction, and Ken's right that fiction is very low, but nonfiction is higher, are electronic. One-third of people prefer print, and one-third are hybrid buyers. But that doesn't describe the entire market. E-books are differentially adopted by one of the core library user bases, which is women who read literature. And
yes.
So the people who are using the e-book readers the most are women between 25 and 45, which is one of our core markets when women have their kids.
And the largest growth area for e-books is actually children's picture books.
Picture books on as an app, but also the least fast adoption is amongst teens. Teens do what they're told, but there's reasons to why ebooks are good for teens and are especially good for teen boys with reading issues is the ability to listen to a book while you're reading it increases comprehension, and print books don't do that, and the ability to bump up the font for kids who have reading challenges in grades 6, 7, 8. When you can bump up the font of something, for some reason, kids with reading issues increase very quickly their reading speed and their comprehension. So there are reasons to encourage kids, especially specific kids, to do it. The other piece is when you get to university, you're going to find most of your course packs and everything are very rapidly moving to an ebook framework. since 70% of high school graduates go on to university and most people don't stay in a small community, one of our challenges is that young adults who arrive at university from smaller communities fail university at much higher rates than kids who come from urban centers. So I see public libraries as part of the framework for helping kids understand how to use databases and how to experience some of the things that are frankly more available in a large urban center, and which isn't fair and nor right when there are digital tools available. So we are going to see in the future, next few years, we're going to see conflicting data on the people who like print and the people who like electronic, and libraries will require a foot in both camps. Those who choose not to be in the electronic camp aren't learning for when it starts to hit them even harder, and we're in about the seventh year of a 14th-year adoption cycle.
And I would say, too, that what we're seeing, and I was just talking to one of the collection people in a large library last week, is we're seeing an increase in the digital users, we're seeing a decrease in the print users, and only a 7%, according to this one library system, of an overlap of those who use both. But the people who come through the doors are the print users. The digital users don't step through your doors. They use you completely digitally.
And this is one of the challenges of librarians believing what they're seeing, which is totally natural in the olden days. But our in-house users do not represent in most libraries, the majority of their use, when you count website hits and downloads and stuff like that, is coming virtually. And the people in communities where you can't get to a college or university easily and taking e-learning, the public library is their digital and print library to support their online education. Do we have another question, Jay? Thank you for that question, Bracebridge.
The next question comes from the Caledon Public Library. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. This is Bill Manson from Caledon. I want to go back to something you said at the top of your comments, Ken, and that's that the customers who want us to change least are the ones who use us the most. And that's certainly true. We're going through one of the counting opinions cycles that we go through fairly frequently and find that our customers are a hell of a lot more supportive of how good we are than we are when we look at the numbers that we see. They think we're doing a lot better than we think we're doing. Part of that is because what they like is the traditional service. And so one of the real challenges that we face is moving our committed users off the dime. And it's one of those things where it becomes particularly true when we're looking to the future, even in small things, like the fact that I'm still doing 25% of my circulations are of DVDs. And I know that DVDs are a dead format, or will be soon. And thanks to reading the Stevens Lighthouse, I'm seeing the Netflix getting into the book business and quiver at the thought of a subscription of whatever it is, $8 a month for all the books you can read. It looks like a paid subscription library may be our biggest competition in time to come.
Ken, you're the techie.
One moment, please.
I'm worried Ken drove under a bridge. We're coming up to the end of the call. Yeah, those are interesting challenges, Bill. I think that's...
I'm back. I seem to have lost you guys.
Okay. So the question was around competition in changing formats. Like as we try to navigate these waters, from Bill Manson, the transition from DVD to streaming formats and subscription bases to borrowing or buying models, and the same thing, the Netflix for books, if it's $8 a month for all the books that we've seen a number of initiatives come up on, do we have a new competitor, and how do we influence on that scale?
And we do. And I think it is. It's a significant competitor when we're talking about those issues. As long as we believe that creators should be paid for their work, there will be people who cannot afford it. And I think that libraries have to make sure that everybody has access to information, knowledge, and to creative thought. And that's never going to change. A couple of years ago when BC upped the cost of your normal phone line by a dollar or two, the percentage of the province that actually used that phone service went down significantly. So even small amounts of money can affect significant portions of the population. My parents were not library users. They did not value reading. And if it had not been for the library, nobody would have given me the Netflix equivalent of library books for $8 a month. I needed a library, and I needed that material for free, or I never would have had it. And I think that we will always be important in that way.
So that's a wonderful back to basic principles on libraries bridging every community's needs in different ways. Do we have time for one more question, Jay?
Certainly. We have an additional question from Whitby Public Library. Your line is open.
Hello, Whitby.
Hi, Ken and Stephen. It's Ian Ross from Whitby calling. We're in the process of developing a new strategic plan, and one part of it is going to be to measure our progress. And, of course, what we're all doing is moving from reporting outputs to demonstrating meaningful outcomes. Can either of you give me tips, because I find this component of our strategic plan somewhat daunting, can you give me any tips on how we can effectively approach meaningful measurements of what we do and then reporting them effectively?
Ken.
Well, go ahead, Steve.
No, you go ahead.
I mean, I'm a big believer in the community study or survey, and I think that if you're actually going to measure outputs or impacts, then it has to be something that the user is telling you what their perception of it is. It can't be, we did 5 more adult programs. Well, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or our attendance went up for the 15 programs that we did in this area. Who cares? What really makes the difference is, what is the impact of youth in terms of the community itself, and do they believe that you're doing a good job? And that's the ultimate indicator, because it's the it means that you are being visible in what it is that you're doing. So I think that if you're dealing with a plan where it is talking about impact on the community, there has to be a baseline sort of study or survey that is done in the beginning with some distinct output levels that you want to measure, like how well does the community view us as a community partner that's addressing literacy issues, or how well do they address a particular service, and then you need to measure that at the end and see if there's been an improvement. That's when your feet are held.
And I think, Ken, it needs to be tied to what you said you were going to do, and tagging on to your original thing about building credibility, delivering. But you have to deliver on what you said you were going to do. Am I going to make a difference on teen engagement? Am I going to make a difference on homework and school scores? And am I going to make a difference on new business incubation in our community, so we have more businesses resident in our community and we're not just a commuter town?
Yeah, I saw a library in the States that was assigning a librarian to every group of graduating students from the local university that were starting their own business and establishing it within the community. They assigned a librarian to help them do research for their new business.
Awesome.
Wow, that was great.
Well, we've come to the end of our time, and I just want to thank everyone for attending. There will be a recording of this session, and of course I want to extend my extreme personal thanks and the thanks on behalf of FOPL to Ken Roberts for dangerously driving, talking on a hands-free phone in his car. But I really appreciate Ken's insights, and he's done us a big favor by talking to us and FOPL today. Thank you, Ken.
Okay, I'm going to head out because I've got to go to my session.
Okay, bye-bye. And I'll just remind everybody that we've got some more sessions coming up, and the schedule is on the FOPL website. And related to what Ian was talking about, Jane Dysart and I are creating a symposium at the University of Toronto iSchool, to which FOPL members will have a discounted attendance, on new measurements for libraries and developing impact measurements and outcome measurements and visualizing them and making